Grade 7 Conference, Lecture 75, Physiology 14. We're going to conclude our discussion of physiology with one more look at the eye. And all of this, which is completely superficial, is not meant to be your block, but rather to spur you on, to enthuse you, or get you deeply interested, perhaps, in one or another aspect of human physiology, in which you may never have, you know, experienced much interest. Here you also see why, for blocks like this, oh, to have a school doctor, wouldn't that be wonderful? Somebody who, you know, knows the human being inside and out, but also as an anthroposophical doctor really can relate it to the child in front of you. That would be great. But ladies and gentlemen, most of you are going to have to do that on your own. Be the doctor as well as the teacher, in addition to being the marriage counselor, the school veterinarian, whatever, you know, the whole thing. Okay, now we're going to leave the metabolic and rhythmic areas of the eye. So on the outside of the eye, the closer it is to the world, the less it is a sense organ, pure and simple, and the more it is actually a metabolic organ and a rhythmic organ. And now we're going to go into the nerve sense part, the real sensory part of the sense organ, and that begins very much with the retina. So the retina is really, really super thin. It's, you know, of the nature of like that little window in the cochlea, incredibly thin and yet so very important. So you see how when something really important is going on in the human being, you get an almost ethereal organ, an organ that's almost not there, that certainly we think of the drop of water in the cochlea or the ossicles. These things that couldn't even be discovered for thousands of years because they're so small. And that's where you find things that are very, very important. So the retina is 0.5 millimeter thick at most, and yet it has 10 layers of cells. There's something going on there, a degree of complexity. And this is where the rods and cones are. And one, you know, sort of hears about this, but maybe you've never given it any thought or looked into it. Let me share some thoughts with you. So the elongated rod cells, they're very small structures, and they're especially found in the periphery of the retina. And the small and more compact cone cells they're concentrated more towards the retina center, though not exactly the center, off-center, but there's a greater concentration of them. I'm not sure how they got the names rods and cones, because if you look at microscopic images or anatomical drawings of them, you know, they look the same. Just one is bigger and one is smaller, but otherwise it's not very different. But it has a lot to do with where they are. That's really important. And if you want to go in this direction, and I see no harm at this point in the seventh grader's life of showing them a photograph from a microscope or a drawing that is based on a microscope, and look at these very, very small formations, which have a lot to do with our vision altogether, and especially the way we see color. So here we are again in that world of the deeds and sufferings of light, the interplay of light and darkness. If you are able to magnify an image with labels, scientific names for the parts of the rods and cones, you're going to see an outer segment, a slender connecting stalk, and a what's called a basal portion, you know, kind of anchoring it. And in the outer segment, we find something that's called the endoplasmic reticulum. And this, you see, it's like a kind of labyrinthine windings. It looks like a little bit of an intestinal tract. And remember, Steiner said the cochlea was the intestine migrating in our ear. And here we have another remarkable little labyrinth of an intestine in these, you know, microscopic cones and rods. And then there's the bridge part of it, the connecting stalk. And there you've got the cilium, these very, very fine hair-like formations. So there again and again, we come upon the villi and the little hairs here and there, these little fingers, these little touching. But these are very much, these particular ones, they're very, very much like the hair-like formations found in the lungs. So there's this central kind of rhythmic breathing quality here. And then in the basal portion, you find the mitochondria. That's called, you know, sort of the source of energy of the cell. The little brain, we might say, the nerve sense part. So even down to the most microscopic structure, we see this quality of threefolding that's going on. So how do they work? They are very sensitive to the interplay of light and darkness. And that means, of course, they're involved with color. The rod cells contain a rosy pink pigment, which is called rhodopsin. Also, you've probably heard of it as visual purple. And when a light shines into the eye, the rhodopsin gets bleached immediately, and the light bleaching turns it into a visual yellow, retinine. So it moves from purple to yellow. Complementary color, interesting. Now, maybe you're thinking of Roberto's wonderful, vivid demonstrations of colored shadows in the light and color instructional film that we have. Yeah, exactly. There you have something of a key of this, the after image and so on. What is going on in the most minute structures within our eye? So deeds and suffering of light, even on the level of the electron microscope, they're yielding color. And we can say that when light enters, that even at this microcosmic level, light and darkness have to be sensed by the nerve sense pole, the mitochondria. They have to be rhythmically worked over as they move through the little hairs. And finally, they have to be digested in the endoplasmic reticulum. And then we can see. So everything, down to the smallest, has to go through this threefold process so that we can have any kind of an experience, even a sensory one. And there's something else interesting about the retina, many interesting things. It's not only where light and darkness meet and we start to have a seeing experience, we might say, it's also where blood and nerve meet. Because the optic nerves on the anterior side of the retina, they unite at one spot, and then they turn back to the posterior side of the retina. So there's a point of union where they come together, and that's called the optic disc. And that little spot is also where the blood vessels enter the eye. So just where the nerve fibers are leaving and going out towards the brain, that's where the blood can move in. I always think of that old statement, when God closes a door, he also opens a window. So blood and nerve meet, but they only meet in exiting and entering. Like it's kind of a revolving door, we might say. Where they can avoid each other, they prefer that. Because remember, the blood is carrying something of, you know, the etheric nature of the human being very strongly. The nerves are very, very astral. And they sometimes have to work together, but it's not always a matter of their first choice. It's also interesting that at this point of exit for the nerves, an entry of the blood is what is called our blind spot. And I'm sure you've all had this experience of these little, you know, optical illusions with an X and an O, and you move the paper away from you or towards you, and then you can't see the X anymore because your blind spot is active. Where our retina is most alive, the only place where the rivers of blood, and it is like a little canal system with rivers flowing in, where the blood comes in, that is where we can't see because the nerve has left. So where our eye is most truly alive, it is useless as a sensory organ. Something very different is going on. It's out to lunch. Literally, it's being nourished so that it can be sustained at all. The eye doesn't need a whole lot of support from our circulatory system, but it needs something to remain alive. And while it is digesting that, while it's taking in its source of life, we can't see. So the ability to see, the ability to open our eyes and see, truly it is related with a turning away from the tree of life. Okay? We eat of the tree of knowledge. That's bad enough. But then we're told, you're not going to touch the tree of life. Where there is life, you will still be asleep. That isn't yours yet. And so that is definitely true within our eye. Where the four rivers of blood flow, we are blind. Where they are least evident, where there is little or almost no blood in the retina, which is a slight distance away from the blind spot, there we have the fovea or macula. And that is the point of our most acute vision, and that is where we have the concentration of the rods and cones. And that is where the eye is closest to being truly dead or nearly dead. So, and I'm sure that you've all heard of something called macular degeneration. This is growing more and more common in our time. It especially afflicts people who have diabetes, where often then there are a whole host of secondary degenerative problems that arise, macular degeneration being one of them. But it's also, you know, part of the fact that people are living longer. And because, again, the macula has so little life inherently, as soon as our etheric body begins to expand as we age, the macula is going to give up the little that it has. But while it is healthy, that is where we see with the most acute vision. That is where we focus. The fovea centralis, that term isn't used so much anymore, but macula is. That is focus sight. And we could say then that as we focus, we are acting out of that part of our nature with the least life. And now we can understand, if we haven't really understood it before, why we take so long to teach children to read in the Waldorf school. We want them to work, first of all, with their ears. We want the children to hear the story. Then we want them to use their peripheral vision, so we draw big pictures with bright color. And that really works with the part of the eye that is most alive. Because a first grader probably is much stronger in his peripheral vision than in his focused foveal or macular vision. Only little by little do we shrink the picture down until finally it's a letter. And there again, we tend to draw those letters by hand, maybe with beeswax crayons, so they're kind of big and thick, before we give them the skinny letters in books. Once they start to focus on that, that is stimulating the macular vision, and that tends to be an either-or situation. From that point on, we have to work very hard to reawaken our peripheral vision. Interesting, when I would take my class on these kind of wilderness trips with guides, not led by me, you know, and then they'd say, okay, everybody, put on your packs and, you know, dress warmly. We're going on an all-night hike or something like that. Do I have to come? Of course you come, Mr. Schwartz. It's a big treat. So anyway, what they're telling the students is don't kind of stare ahead of you. We're not going to use flashlights. Don't stare ahead of you thinking that you're going to be able to see things the way you do in the day. Relax your eyes and kind of let them wander a bit right and left. Use your peripheral vision and you'll be able to see things. You'll be amazed. You'll see things in front of you better that way. And even I got to try that. Very, very interesting. Takes a little while to get used to, but it's as though your peripheral vision carries its own source of light. You've got a flashlight there, and you can see how people got along for, you know, many tens of thousands of years without needing even torches, no less flashlights, and why we are so dependent on flashlights at night and car mirrors, all of our rear view mirrors, and now, you know, the LED screens that we have in our cars so that we can see what's behind us and around us. We don't trust our peripheral vision anymore. In that is life, and whatever we can do to keep that alive, especially in the first three grades, so much the better. And, okay, that's our retina. I have more to say about that. And I just want to take this a little bit further and think of something to go back now to the eye and the ear. How does the Hebrew scriptures begin the story of creation? God said, "Let there be light." Begins with light. So we could say the Israelites, the ancient Hebrews, who were destined to be the most wakeful people on the earth and to help the rest of humanity awaken, whose eyes were indeed opened, as we were told, to see that light, they see creation as the beginning of the light. And therefore, the eye is the organ which is born, is made to witness that creation. What do we hear of the creation in the New Testament? What do we hear in the Gospel of John? In the beginning was the Word, and the Word created everything. It was the Word that shone, as it were, in the darkness, and the ear was the organ meant to perceive that creative force. Isn't this interesting? The eye and the ear, really the organs of the Old Testament, Hebrew Scriptures, and the New Testament. And we could say where we can bring the eye and the ear together, there we are going to effect a tremendous synthesis, not only of two very different worldviews, but of ourselves, of our own being. And where do we find these two coming together? In the organ of balance. Now, I never had the time to teach about that in physiology. Maybe you will. But even if you're not going to teach it, please do study it a little bit. Read what Steiner has to say about it and just look into it yourself. In that book I was telling you about, Seeing, Hearing, Learning, I talk a great deal about that organ and how it is really bringing balance between the forces of the ear and the forces of the eye. And I share some incredible things that Steiner had to say about those organs, which I haven't even approached in these physiology lectures. So that brings the physiology block to a conclusion. I do hope you are the one teaching this to your children. It is, you know, it's sinful if somebody else takes over, the high school life sciences teacher or someone. You know, as I said, to bring in a parent who's a nurse, who's a doctor, as long as they're not overly intellectual, you know, that's great to bring them in. But that you are the one who know these children so well on a level of soul and hopefully spirit, that you should be the one really opening up the inner nature of their physical being to them. A very profound experience. Some of the most memorable moments I have in all my, you know, the four times I've taught seventh and eighth grade, have to do with the physiology and the anatomy blocks. And what these children said and what they understood and what they were like afterwards. Very interesting. And I hope you are vouchsafed that experience as well.